afternoon here, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 16, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Guinea's military junta may need up to $600 million to hold elections.
We got that figure, but from the document that we received, it seemed to me that it is an estimate based on different hypotheses.
Sierra Leone's main opposition says it is getting overtures from non-governmental organizations for possible dialogue with the government. Teachers of Ghana's College of Education push for the government to implement an agreement on compensation and allowances. DRC President Felix Tshisekedi calls on rebel groups in eastern Congo to lay down their weapons. Kenyan President Ruto reinstates a small subsidy to stabilize fuel prices.
I don't think these subsidies will be sustainable for two reasons. Obviously, the pressure from the World Bank and IMF. Secondly, the government just doesn't have the money to support these subsidies.
And sandstorms are swallowing a Somali coastal town. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Guinea's military junta says it would need about $600 million to hold elections, but critics say such an amount may be an excuse for the junta not to arrange a vote that would return the country to civilian rule. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has urged the region's military-led countries, Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Mali, to return to democratic rule within 24 months. Fayami Limono is the leader of the opposition Liberal Bloc Party in Guinea. He tells me that he has met with the junta and that the $600 million cost is probably an estimate based on various scenarios.
I went to some meetings with the Prime Minister as well as with the Minister of Territorial Administration. We got that figure. But from the document that we received, it seemed to me that it is an estimate based on different hypotheses. One of the hypotheses is that if the parliamentary elections are held and voters are only those living inside the country, they estimated the budget for that. If we have to have elections in 25 more countries where you have Guineans, they have estimated also that figure. And if we added like 35 other countries, there is another estimate. So the 600 million is like the most expensive hypothesis that gave that figure. Otherwise, I don't think that we need 500 or even $400 million to go through the process, taking us back to constitutional life.
Did anyone, for example, the ECOWAS or anyone else, promise the military junta that they will give the military some money to hold election? I'm asking this question because there are those who say that perhaps the military is trying to avoid having election.
I mean, you remember at the beginning of this transitional period, political and social actors were debating about how long this transition is going to last. We were about to agree on 36 months, which would have been 3 years period. It was exactly at that time that ECOWAS sent the experts to negotiate with the junta and the government. They agree upon the 24 months. And according to the government, ECOWAS has promised to work and get the money from partners. Now, what we've been hearing is like nobody is doing anything. During our meeting with the Minister of Territorial Administration, we have seen that the government has funded some of the activities. But what is missing is more than what the government has done. So in some way, ECOWAS has to is part with the international community as they have given their word to the junta.
Faye Milimono is the leader of the Liberal Bloc Party of Guinea. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. Sierra Leone's main opposition, All People's Congress, the APC party, says that some non-governmental organizations are making overtures for possible talks with the government. The Commonwealth Secretary General earlier this month offered to facilitate a peaceful and constructive dialogue. Since the country's June 24th election, the APC has rejected the results and refused to participate at any level of governance because it says the government tampered with the count to hand itself the majority. Sidi Yaya Tunis is the APC National Publicity Secretary. He tells me that the APC has met with the Inter-Religious Council and the Commission for Peace and National Cohesion.
They wanted to hear firsthand from us what our problems were with the elections process and the violations that we felt we had to go through as a party before the elections, during the elections, and after the elections. And so they wanted to see how they can also come in to facilitate possible dialogue. We were able to provide them, you know, some of our concerns. We also directed them to some of the incidents that happened, not only in our party office in Freetown, but in other areas across the country.
So you talk about your concerns. There was an election that the Election Commission said President Madabio won, and your party, the APC, has been protesting. What are the concerns?
Well, you know, after the elections, the APC put forward certain demands. For example, they demanded the resignation of the Electoral Commissioner, Chief Justice, the Inspector General of Police, as well as the Chief of Defense Staff. But more importantly, also, they asked for the disaggregated data, elections results, by polling stations to be published by the Electoral Commission of Sierra Leone. The party demanded that a rerun be done in 6 months because they are not satisfied with the results as announced by the Chief Electoral Commissioner, and that for now the party will boycott governance until these demands are met, especially that which has to do with the publication of our elections results by polling stations.
The president has said he's willing to form a commission to look into the conduct of Sierra Leone elections.
Well, we have not had direct talks with the government yet, with President Bio's team. Like we have always stated, the demands that we put forward really had nothing to do with President Bio or the SLPP. Our problems are with our specific institutions of the state, which is why our demands were really directed to those institutions. And whatever interventions that are going to happen, we are very much aware that, you know, for some of those to be met, there has to be some amount of interventions. And that is why we have always maintained as a party.
Sidi Yaya Tunis is the National Publicity Secretary of the opposition All People's Congress Party of Sierra Leone. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. The Colleges of Education Teachers Association of Ghana will meet the National Labour Commission today, Wednesday, about implementing an agreement on compensation and allowances. The Labour Commission had issued an award order on May the 2nd, which the government has yet to implement. The teachers' group embarked on a strike, saying the administration has failed to act despite repeated promises to do so. Students of the 46 public colleges of education are also calling on authorities to resolve the impasse so that they can return to school. VOA's Peter Clotty spoke with Prince Obeng Hima, president of the Colleges of Education Teachers Association of Ghana.
The association and government reached an agreement through negotiations for conditions of service for the tutors. And even with that, we had to take the negotiation from the Fair Wages and Salaries Commission that is mandated to negotiate for and on behalf of government. We lost faith in them, having been engaged for over a year without any sign of a conclusion. So we took it to the National Labor Commission and then asked that they trigger compulsory arbitration, which is in their books. They did so, and then we arrived at the conditions of service in May 2nd. The National Labor Commission, which has the powers of the High Court, gave orders for compliance, and the orders included the government immediately paying or implementing the conditions of service that have been signed.
Some people are suggesting that if there have been attempts at negotiations and the government is open for negotiations, why embark on the strike to press home your demands? Because they said it represents bad faith from you and your organization. Your response to that?
Those who say that do not simply understand the matter, because negotiation is over. If we don't conclude negotiation, we'll never sign off to indicate that we have finished. So the moment we sign off and then two parties agree that there is a package, and then it goes to the finance ministry, it's left to be, implemented. And implementing this, you don't need CETAC's involvement in any way to be able to, implement that. So negotiation is off the table. It's concluded.
What about those who are of the view that the government doesn't have any money? They cited instances where the country, they said, is broke. The government has to go borrow money, and that your demands are unreasonable, and that you should have patience for the government to try to address your concerns instead of embarking on this strike action.
We totally disagree with that assertion, because this is even the time Ghanaians, we need to work so hard to be able to push the economic frontiers of the nation. And you can't take education out of this. In the current situation that we find ourselves in, every worker has got its own conditions of service. So you cannot say because we are in a dire economic situation, a group of workers should exist without conditions of service. Besides, there hasn't been any situation or any instance that government has stated that they have no money to pay. So I'm not sure that argument also holds.
Prince Oben Hima is the president of the Ghana Colleges of Education Teachers Association. He was speaking with my colleague Peter Clotte from Accra. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 16. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Kenya has reinstated a small subsidy to stabilize retail fuel prices for the next 30 days, according to local media. The move is a reversal of government policy after public anger over the high cost of living. But the subsidy costs, as well as recent tax hikes, have increased living costs and contributed to violent anti-government protests. VOA's Douglas Umpunga reached David Monda, a professor of political science at City University of New York, and began by asking him what he thought of the move.
I was actually very surprised about that move, because I know Kenya is under very strict World Bank and IMF conditionality, and these two Bretton Woods institutions, they really look at subsidies as net negatives in the economy, because they feel that unwarranted government interference in the free market, right, of demand and supply. So they see subsidies as unsustainable. So I was really surprised to see the government come in and do that based on the conditionalities from the IMF and World Bank. But I think secondly also that Kenya has been facing a historic deficit, very weak currency. So I was also surprised to find out that, the government's broke without money, yet it's able to provide these subsidies. It will be interesting to see how long these subsidies can really be sustained, because someone has got to pay for them, and it's either going to come through more taxes or cutting of spending. So we'll have to see what happens in that area.
Do you think this move made possible by the protests that have been taking place in Kenya?
I think it was, because there was a lot of pressure on the government to reduce the cost of living. I just think it's politically expedient for the government to try and have this reaction because there's a lot of pressure based on the demonstrations. And the other thing also is the president was losing a lot of support from his supporters, in the Kenya Kwanza coalition, because the economic conditions were becoming so difficult already. The shilling is depreciating and the government raised taxes. So the government had to find a way to try and appease not only supporters, but also to reduce the enthusiasm for the opposition because of the tough economic conditions that were already there.
How do you think Mr. Ruto and his government will balance between the realities of the economy and trying to gain support among his own supporters and even the opposition?
I think, number one, they have to reinstate the subsidies, which they did, which is surprising. But I don't think these subsidies will be sustainable for two reasons. Obviously, the pressure from the World Bank and IMF, the government has signed for more concessionary loans, more long-term funding for the Kenyan budget, where we have deficits. To get that money from the IMF and World Bank, I think there'll be pressure for these subsidies again to be scrapped in the near future. But I think, secondly, the government just doesn't have the money to support these subsidies because subsidies are just not productive.
That was David Monda, professor of political science at City University at New York. He was speaking with VOA's Douglas Mpuga. A three-day roundtable conference taking place in the DRC capital, Kinshasa, will decide on the future of the state of siege in the provinces of Ituri and North Kivu. The meeting comes amid calls from Amnesty International to the DRC authorities to immediately lift the state of siege. Opening the conference on Monday, DRC President Felix Tshisekedi called upon rebel groups in the provinces of Ituri and North Kivu to put down their weapons and join what he has dubbed the disarmament and reinsertion operation. Reporter Jaffa Al-Katanti is at the meeting in Kinshasa.
Political actors and members of the civil society in Ituri province and North Kivu province, and also those at the national level of DRC, are participating in this conference in which the government of DRC will have to take a decision to maintain or to lift the state of siege in these two provinces of Eastern Congo. The goal is to push the government to take this decision because of how the Congolese people in these two provinces are thinking about the state of siege. Since the establishment of the state of siege, which was on the goal of making end to insecurity, wars, and armed groups, nothing had been changed. The situation is becoming more and more lost. In North Kivu, for example, there was few rebel groups before the state of siege than today. For example, M23, which is the most active armed group who is involved in the east of DRC. But before the state of siege, there was not M23.
What do the people of Eastern DR Congo think of this state of siege, as you call it, or the state of emergency in the area?
People in North Kivu and Ituri are not anymore trusting on the governor and their teams during this state of siege. The result is not what people expected. When the state of siege was established, everybody in North Kivu and Ituri or in the Eastern Congo thought that this decision is to make end automatically on the situation which people are passing in Eastern Congo. But now, as the result is not what expected, no one is trusting or believing in the state of siege anymore. So this is the point of view of many people who are from Goma, from Masisi, Ruchuru, even in Ituri.
That's reporter Jaffa Al-Katanti. He was speaking from Kinshasa with my colleague Douglas Mpuga. Residents of Hobyo, Somalia, say drifting sandstorms are burying their homes, schools, and shops, and threatening the existence of the coastal town. Abdul Kader Zubair and Abdulaziz Osman have this story, narrated by Salim Solomon.
Residents of Hobyo, Somalia say sandstorms are swallowing part of their town, making it disappear before their eyes. Osman Ahmed Abdulle, the mayor of the town of about 11,000 people, says the sandstorms are driven by climate change, but deforestation and drought also play a role.
You were looking at how the main road coming from Galkayo is closed. A lot of drifting sand is coming from there. There are many neighborhoods that have been buried by the sandstorm. There are many houses that have been buried here. You were looking at that house as an example.
In the north-central Mudug region of Somalia, Hobyo was once a center for piracy that spiked in 2009-2010. However, in recent years, Hobyo has become one of the most climate-vulnerable towns in Somalia, and many people have been displaced. Hobyo resident Ali Aden Abdullah says the sun buried homes, shops, and schools and forced people to move.
Half of the population had already fled as the sandstorm spread everywhere in the town. Now the sand is reaching the walls of the main hospital and the state house, and both could be buried if it's not stopped.
The sandstorms in Hobyo and the recurring droughts serve as stark reminders of the urgent need to address the effects of climate change and protect vulnerable communities, advocates say. During a visit to Somalia in April, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres acknowledged the disproportionate impact of climate change on the Somali people.
Although Somalia makes virtually no contribution to climate change, the Somalis are among the greatest victims. Nearly 5 million people are experiencing high levels of acute food insecurity. And of course, rising prices make matters worse.
To combat climate change, Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud launched a $10 million initiative last month. However, Abdullah, the mayor of Hobyo, says that urgent action is needed and his town cannot wait for long-term initiatives to take effect. He specifically called on people from Hobyo living abroad to return and contribute to saving the town.
Anyone who can bring us ideas, can support us financially, should take part in saving the environment. Anyone who can build houses is welcome, because more houses will reduce the drifting sand. So the people of Hobyo are welcome to come back.
Somalia's president launched an initiative called Regreening Somalia in October 2022 with the aim of expediting reforestation efforts and combating desertification. Somalia's government has also set the ambitious goal of achieving 30% forest cover by 2030 through agroforestry and sustainable land management. For Abdul Qadir Zubair in Hobyo, Somalia, and Abdulaziz Osman, Salim Solomon, VOA News.
And that's it for this Wednesday, August 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.
Greetings. This is VOA's Sunny Young. Brighten your day by tuning in the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. You can also follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and VOAAfrica.com. It's the sunny side of sports. right here on The Voice of America.